feeling around in the air with its blunt head. Its huge, opaque eyes look like the front end of a riot gear helmet. Maybe it's smelling him, picking up on his chemical aura. "We are not here to play, to dream, to drift," he says to it. "We have hard work to do, and loads to lift." Now what atrophying neural cistern in his brain did that come from? The life skills class in junior high. The teacher had been a shambling neo-con reject from the heady days of the legendary dot-com bubble back in prehistory. He'd had a stringy ponytail stuck to the back of his balding head and a faux leather jacket. He'd worn a gold stud in his bumpy, porous old nose and had pushed self-reliance and individualism and risk-taking in a hopeless tone, as if even he no longer believed in them. Once in a while he'd come out with some hoary maxim, served up with a wry irony that did nothing to reduce the boredom quotient. Or else he'd say, "I could have been a contender," then glare meaningfully at the class, as if there was some deeper-than-deep point they were all supposed to get. Double-entry on-screen bookkeeping. Banking by fingertip. Using a microwave without nuking your egg. Filling out housing applications for this or that module and job applications for this or that compound, family heredity research, negotiating your own marriage and divorce contracts, wise genetic matchmaking, the proper use of condoms to avoid sexually transmitted bioforms, those had been the life skills. None of the kids had paid much attention. They either knew it already or didn't want to. They'd treated the class as a rest hour. "We are not here to play, to dream, to drift. We are here to practice life skills." "Whatever," says Snowman. Or, instead of chess or a journal, he could focus on his living conditions. There's room for improvement in that department, a lot of room. More food sources, for one thing. Why didn't he ever bone up on roots and berries and pointed stick traps for skewering small game and how to eat snakes? Why had he wasted his time? "Oh, honey, don't beat yourself up," breathes a female voice regretfully in his ear. If only he could find a cave, a nice cave with a high ceiling and good ventilation and maybe some running water, he'd be better off. True, there's a stream with fresh water a quarter of a mile away. At one place it widens into a pool. Initially he'd gone there to cool off, but the Krakers might be splashing around in it, or resting on the banks, and the kids would pester him to go swimming, and he didn't like being seen by them without his sheet. Compared to them, he is just too weird. They make him feel deformed. If not people, there might be animals. Wolvogs, pigoons, bobkittens. Watering holes attract carnivores. They lie in wait. They slaver. They pounce. Not very cozy. The clouds are building. The sky darkening. He can't see much through the trees, but he senses the change in light. He slides off into half-sleep and dreams of Oryx, floating on her back in a swimming pool, wearing an outfit that appears to be made of delicate, white, tissue paper petals. They spread out around her, expanding and contracting like the valves of a jellyfish. The pool is painted a vibrant pink. She smiles up at him and moves her arms gently to keep afloat, and he knows they are both in great danger. Then there's a hollow booming sound, like the door of a great vault shutting. Downpour. He awakes to thunder and a sudden wind. The afternoon storm is upon him. He scrambles to his feet, grabs his sheet. Those howlers can come on very fast, and a metal bed frame in a thunderstorm is no place to be. He's built himself an island of car tires back in the woods. It's simply a matter of crouching on them, keeping their insulation between himself and the ground until the storm is over. Sometimes there are hailstones as big as golf balls, but the forest canopy slows their fall. He reaches the pile of tires just as the storm breaks. Today it's only rain, the usual deluge. So heavy the impact turns the air to mist. Water sluices down onto him as the lightning sizzles. Branches thrash around overhead, rivulets amble along the ground. Already it's cooling down. The scent of freshly washed leaves and wet earth fills the air. Once the rain is slowed to a drizzle and the rumbles of thunder have receded, he slogs back to his cement slab cache to collect the empty beer bottles. Then he makes his way to a jagged concrete overhang that was once part of a bridge. Beneath it, there's a triangular orange sign with the black silhouette of a man shoveling. Men at work, that used to mean. Strange to think of the endless labor, the digging, the hammering, the carving, the lifting, the drilling, day by day, year by year, century by century. And now the endless crumbling that must be going on everywhere. Sand castles in the wind. Runoff is pouring through a hole in the side of the concrete. He stands under it with his mouth open, gulping water full of grit and twigs and other things he doesn't want to think about. The water must have found a channel through derelict houses and pungent cellars and clotted up ditches and who knows what else. Then he rinses himself off, wrings out his sheet. He doesn't get himself very clean this way, but at least he can shed the surface layer of grime and scum. It would be useful to have a bar of soap. He keeps forgetting to pick one up during his pilfering excursions. Lastly, he fills up the beer bottles. He should get himself a better vessel, a thermos or a pail, something that would hold more. Also, the bottles are awkward. They're slippery and hard to position. He keeps imagining he can still smell beer inside them, though it's only wishful thinking. Let's pretend this is beer. He shouldn't have brought that up. He shouldn't torture himself. He shouldn't dangle impossibilities in front of himself as if he were some caged, wired-up lab animal, trapped into performing futile and perverse experiments on his own brain. Get me out, he hears himself thinking. But he isn't locked up. He's not in prison. What could be more out than where he is? I didn't do it on purpose, he says in the sniveling child's voice he reverts to in this mood. Things happened. I had no idea. It was out of my control. What could I have done? Just someone, anyone. Listen to me, please. What a bad performance. Even he isn't convinced by it. But now he's weeping again. It is important, says the book in his head, to ignore minor irritants, to avoid pointless repinings, and to turn one's mental energies to immediate realities and to the tasks at hand. He must have read that somewhere. Surely his own mind would never have come up with pointless repinings, not all by itself. He wipes his face on a corner of the sheet. Pointless repinings, he says out loud. As often, he feels he has a listener, someone unseen, hidden behind the screen of leaves, watching him slyly. 4. Rackunk. He does have a listener. It's a rackunk, a young one. He can see it now, its bright eyes peering out at him from under a bush. Here, girl. Here, girl, he says to it coaxingly. It backs away into the underbrush. If he worked at it, if he really tried, he could probably tame one of those, and then he'd have someone to talk to. Someone to talk to was nice, Oryx used to tell him. You should try it sometime, Jimmy, she'd say, kissing him on the ear. But I talk to you, he'd protest. Another kiss. Do you? When Jimmy was 10, he'd been given a pet rackunk by his father. What did his father look like? Snowman can't get a fix on it. Jimmy's mother persists as a clear image, full color, with a glossy white paper frame around her like a Polaroid, but he can recall his father only in details. The Adam's apple going up and down when he swallowed, the ears backlit against the kitchen window, the left hand lying on the table, cut off by the shirt cuff. His father is a sort of pastiche. Maybe Jimmy could never get far enough away from him to see all the parts at once. The occasion for the gift of the rackunk must have been his birthday. He's repressed his birthdays. They weren't a matter for general celebration, not after Dolores, the live-in Filipina, left. When she was there, she'd always remember his birthday. She'd make a cake, or maybe she'd buy one. But anyway, there it would be, a genuine cake, with icing and candles. Isn't that true? He clutches onto the reality of those cakes. He closes his eyes, conjures them up, hovering all in a row, their candles alight, giving off their sweet, comforting scent of vanilla, like Dolores herself. His mother, on the other hand, could never seem to recall how old Jimmy was, or what day he was born. He'd have to remind her at breakfast. Then she'd snap out of her trance and buy him some mortifying present. Pajamas for little kids with kangaroos or bears on them. A disc nobody under 40 would ever listen to. Underwear ornamented with whales, and tape it up in tissue paper and dump it on him at the dinner table, smiling her increasingly weird smile, as if someone had yelled, "Smile!" and goosed her with a fork. Then his father would put them all through an awkward excuse about why this really, really special and important date had somehow just slid out of his head, and ask Jimmy if everything was okay, and send him an e-birthday card. The organ ink standard design with 5 winged pigoons doing a conga line, and, "Happy birthday, Jimmy, may all your dreams come true," and come up with a gift for him the day after. A gift that would not be a gift, but some tool, or intelligence-enhancing game, or other hidden demand that he measure up. But measure up to what? There was never any standard. Or there was one, but it was so cloudy and immense that nobody could see it, especially not Jimmy. Nothing he could achieve would ever be the right idea, or enough. By organ inks, math, and chem, and applied bio yardstick, he must have seemed dull normal. Maybe that was why his father stopped telling him he could do much better if he'd only try, and switched to doling out secretly disappointed praise, as if Jimmy had a brain injury. So Snowman has forgotten everything else about Jimmy's 10th birthday except the raconk, brought home by his father in a carry cage. It was a tiny one, smallest of the litter born from the second generation of raconks, the offspring of the first pair that had been spliced. The rest of the litter had been snapped up immediately. Jimmy's father made out that he'd had to spend a great deal of his time and throw his weight around and pull a lot of strings to get hold of this one, but all the effort had been worth it for this really, really special day, which had just happened as usual to fall on the day before. The raconks had begun as an after-hours hobby on the part of one of the organ ink biolab hotshots. There'd been a lot of fooling around in those days. Create an animal was so much fun, said the guys doing it. It made you feel like God. A number of the experiments were destroyed because they were too dangerous to have around. Who needed a cane toad with a prehensile tail like a chameleon's that might climb in through the bathroom window and blind you while you were brushing your teeth? Then there was the snat, an unfortunate blend of snake and rat. They'd had to get rid of those. But the raconks caught on as pets inside organ ink. They hadn't come in from the outside world, the world outside the compound, so they had no foreign microbes and were safe for the pigoons. In addition to which, they were cute. The little raconk let Jimmy pick it up. It was black and white. Black mask, white stripe down its back, black and white rings around its fluffy tail. It licked Jimmy's fingers, and he fell in love with it. "No smell to it, not like a skunk," said Jimmy's father. "It's a clean animal with a nice disposition. Placid. Raccoons never made good pets. Once they were grown up, they got crabby. They'd tear your house to pieces. This thing is supposed to be calmer. We'll see how the little guy does. Right, Jimmy?" Jimmy's father had been apologetic towards him lately, as if he'd punished Jimmy for something Jimmy hadn't done and was sorry about it. He was saying, "Right, Jimmy?" a bit too much. Jimmy didn't like that. He didn't like being the one handing out the good marks. There were a few other moves of his father's he could do without as well. The sucker punches, the ruffling of the hair, the way of pronouncing the word son in a slightly deeper voice. This hearty way of talking was getting worse, as if his father were auditioning for the role of dad, but without much hope. Jimmy had done enough faking himself so he could spot it in others most of the time. He stroked the little raconk and didn't answer. "Who's going to feed it and empty the litter box?" said Jimmy's mother. "Because it won't be me." She didn't say this angrily, but in a detached, matter-of-fact voice, as if she was a bystander, someone on the sidelines, as if Jimmy and the chore of taking care of him and his unsatisfactory father, and the scufflings between her and him, and the increasingly heavy baggage of all their lives, had nothing to do with her. She didn't seem to get angry anymore. She didn't go charging out of the house in her slippers. she had become slowed down and deliberate. "Jimmy hasn't asked you to. He'll do it himself. Right, Jimmy?" said his father. "What are you going to call it?" said his mother. She didn't really want to know. She was getting at Jimmy in some way. She didn't like it when he warmed up to anything his father gave him. "Bandit, I suppose?" That was exactly the name Jimmy had been thinking of, because of the black mask. "No," he said. "That's boring. I'm calling him Killer."
"Good choice, son," said his father.
"Well, if Killer wets on the floor, be sure you clean it up," said his mother. Jimmy took Killer up to his room, where it made a nest in his pillow. It did have a faint smell, strange but not unpleasant, leathery and sharp, like a bar of designer soap for men. He slept with his arm crooked around it, his nose next to its own small nose. It must have been a month or two after he got the Rackunk that Jimmy's father changed jobs. He was headhunted by New Skins and hired at the second-in-command level, the vice level, Jimmy's mother called it. Ramona, the lab tech from Organ Inc., made the move with him. She was part of the deal because she was an invaluable asset, said Jimmy's father. She was his right-hand man. "Joke," he would say to Jimmy, to show that he knew Ramona wasn't really a man, but Jimmy knew that anyway. Jimmy was more or less glad he might still be seeing Ramona at lunch. At least she was someone familiar, even though his lunches with his father had become few in number and far between. New Skins was a subsidiary of Healthwiser, and so they moved into the Healthwiser compound. Their house this time was in the style of the Italian Renaissance, with an arched portico and a lot of glazed earth-tone tiles, and the indoor pool was bigger. Jimmy's mother called it this barn. She complained about the tight security at the Healthwiser gates. The guards were ruder, they were suspicious of everyone, they liked to strip-search people, women especially. They got a kick out of it, she said. Jimmy's father said she was making a big deal about nothing. Anyway, he said, there'd been an incident only a few weeks before they'd moved in. Some fanatic, a woman, with a hostile bioform concealed in a hairspray bottle. Some vicious Ebola or Marburg splice, one of the fortified hemorrhagics. She'd nuked a guard who'd unwisely had his face mask off, contrary to orders, but because of the heat. The woman had been spray-gunned at once and neutralized in a vat of bleach, and the poor guard had been whisked into hot bioform and stuck into an isolation room where he dissolved into a puddle of goo. No greater damage done, but naturally the guards were jumpy. Jimmy's mother said that didn't change the fact that she felt like a prisoner. Jimmy's father said she didn't understand the reality of the situation. Didn't she want to be safe? Didn't she want her son to be safe? "So it's for my own good," she said. She was cutting a piece of French toast into even-sided cubes, taking her time. "For our own good. For us." "Well, I happen to disagree."
"No news there," said Jimmy's father.
According to Jimmy's mother, their phones and email were bugged, and the sturdy, laconic Healthwiser house cleaners that came twice a week, always in pairs, were spies. Jimmy's father said she was getting paranoid, and anyway they had nothing to hide, so why worry about it? The Healthwiser compound was not only newer than the Organ Inc. layout, it was bigger. It had two shopping malls instead of one, a better hospital, three dance clubs, even its own golf course. Jimmy went to the Healthwiser public school, where at first he didn't know anyone. Despite his initial loneliness, that wasn't too bad. Actually, it was good, because he could recycle his old routines and jokes. The kids at Organ Inc. had become used to his antics. He'd moved on from the chimpanzee act and was into fake vomiting and choking to death, both popular, and a thing where he drew a bare-naked girl on his stomach, with her crotch right where his navel was, and made her wiggle. He no longer came home for lunch. He got picked up by the school's combo ethanol solar van in the morning and returned by it at night. There was a bright and cheerful school cafeteria with balanced meals, ethnic choices, pierogies, falafels, and a kosher option, and soy products for the vegetarians. Jimmy was so pleased to be able to eat lunch with neither one of his parents present that he felt lightheaded. He even put on some weight and stopped being the skinniest kid in class. If there was any lunchtime left over and nothing else going on, he could go to the library
and watch old instructional CD-ROMs. Alex the Parrot was his favorite, from Classics in Animal Behavior Studies. He liked the part where Alex invented a new word, corknut for almond, and best of all, the part where Alex got fed up with the blue triangle and yellow square exercise and said, "I'm going away now." "No, Alex, you come back here. Which is the blue triangle?" "No, the blue triangle." But Alex was out the door. 5 stars for Alex. One day Jimmy was allowed to bring Killer to school, where she, it was now officially a she, made a big hit.
"Oh, Jimmy, you are so lucky," said Wakulla Price, the first girl he'd ever had a crush on.
She stroked Killer's fur, brown hand, pink nails, and Jimmy felt shivery, as if her fingers were running over his own body. Jimmy's father spent more and more time at his work, but talked about it less and less. There were pigoons at New Skins, just as at Organ Inc. Farms, but these were smaller and were being used to develop skin-related biotechnologies. The main idea was to find a method of replacing the older epidermis with a fresh one, not a laser-thinned or dermabraded short-term resurfacing, but a genuine start-over skin that would be wrinkle- and blemish-free. For that, it would be useful to grow a young, plump skin cell that would eat up the worn cells in the skins of those on whom it was planted and replace them with replicas of itself, like algae growing on a pond. The rewards in the case of success would be enormous, Jimmy's father explained, doing the straight-talking man-to-man act he had recently adopted with Jimmy. What well-to-do and once-young, once-beautiful woman or man, cranked up on hormonal supplements and shot full of vitamins but hampered by the unforgiving mirror, wouldn't sell their house, their gated retirement villa, their kids and their soul to get a second kick at the sexual can? "New Skins for Olds," said the snappy logo. Not that a totally effective method had been found yet, the dozen or so ravaged hopefuls who had volunteered themselves as subjects, paying no fees but signing away their rights to sue, had come out looking like the mold creature from outer space, uneven in tone, greenish-brown, and peeling in ragged strips. But there were other projects at New Skins as well. One evening, Jimmy's father came home late and a little drunk with a bottle of champagne. Jimmy took one look at this and got himself out of the way. He'd hidden a tiny mic behind the picture of the seashore in the living room, and another one behind the kitchen wall clock, the one that gave a different, irritating bird call for every hour, so he could listen in on stuff that was none of his business. He'd put the mics together in the neo-technology class at school. He'd used standard components out of the mini-mics for wireless computer dictating, which, with a few adjustments, worked fine for eavesdropping.
"What's that for?" said the voice of Jimmy's mother. She meant the champagne.
"We've done it," said Jimmy's father's voice. "I think a little celebration is in order." A scuffle. Maybe he'd tried to kiss her.
"Done what?"
Pop of the champagne cork.
"Come on, it won't bite you."
A pause. He must be pouring it out. Yes. The clink of glasses.
"Here's to us."
"Done what? I need to know what I'm drinking to." Another pause. Jimmy pictured his father swallowing, his Adam's apple going up and down, bobbity-bobble.
"It's the neural regeneration project. We now have genuine, human, neocortex tissue growing in a pigoon. Finally! After all those duds! Think of the possibilities for stroke victims and..."
"That's all we need," said Jimmy's mother. "More people with the brains of pigs. Don't we have enough of those already?
Can't you be positive just for once? All this negative stuff, this is no good, that's no good, nothing's ever good enough according to you."
"Positive about what? That you've thought up yet another way to rip off a bunch of desperate people?" said Jimmy's mother in that new, slow, anger-free voice.
"God, you're cynical."
"No, you are. You and your smart partners. Your colleagues. It's wrong. The whole organization is wrong. It's a moral cesspool, and you know it. We can give people hope. Hope isn't ripping off. At New Skins prices, it is. You hype your wares and take all their money, and then they run out of cash, and it's no more treatments for them. They can rot as far as you and your pals are concerned. Don't you remember the way we used to talk? everything we wanted to do. Making life better for people, not just people with money. You used to be so... You had ideals then.
Sure, said Jimmy's father in a tired voice. I've still got them. I just can't afford them.
A pause. Jimmy's mother must have been mulling that over.
Be that as it may, she said, a sign that she wasn't going to give in. Be that as it may, there's research and there's research. What you're doing, this pig brain thing, you're interfering with the building blocks of life. It's immoral. It's sacrilegious.
Bang, on the table. Not his hand, the bottle. I don't believe I'm hearing this. Who have you been listening to? You're an educated person. You did this stuff yourself. It's just proteins. You know that. There's nothing sacred about cells and tissue. It's just...
I'm familiar with the theory. Anyway, it's been paying for your room and board. It's been putting the food on your table. You're hardly in a position to take the high ground.
I know, said Jimmy's mother's voice. Believe me, that is one thing I really do know.
Why can't you get a job doing something honest? Something basic.
Like what? And like where? You want me to dig ditches?
At least your conscience would be clean.
No, yours would. You're the one with the neurotic guilt. Why don't you dig a few ditches yourself? At least it would get you off your butt. Then maybe you'd quit smoking. You're a one-woman emphysema factory. Plus you're single-handedly supporting the tobacco companies. Think about that if you're so ethical. They're the folks who get six-year-olds hooked for life by passing out free samples.
I know all that.
A pause.
I smoke because I'm depressed. The tobacco companies depress me. You depress me. Jimmy depresses me. He's turning into a...
Take some pills if you're so fucking depressed.
There's no need for swearing.
I think maybe there is.
Jimmy's father yelling wasn't a complete novelty, but combined with the swearing, it got Jimmy's full attention. Maybe there would be action, broken glass. He felt afraid. That cold lump in his stomach was back again, but he also felt compelled to listen. If there was going to be a catastrophe, some final collapse, he needed to witness it.
Nothing happened, though. There was just the sound of footsteps going out of the room.
Which one of them?
Whoever it was would now come upstairs and check to make sure Jimmy was asleep and hadn't heard. Then they could tick off that item on the terrific parenting checklist they both carted around inside their heads. It wasn't the bad stuff they did that made Jimmy so angry. It was the good stuff. The stuff that was supposed to be good, or good enough for him. The stuff they patted themselves on the backs for. They knew nothing about him, what he liked, what he hated, what he longed for. They thought he was only what they could see. A nice boy, but a bit of a goof, a bit of a show-off. Not the brightest star in the universe, not a numbers person, but you couldn't have everything you wanted, and at least he wasn't a total washout. At least he wasn't a drunk or an addict, like a lot of boys his age, so touch wood. He'd actually heard his dad say that. Touch wood, as if Jimmy was bound to fuck up, wander off the tracks, but he just hadn't got around to it yet. About the different, secret person living inside him, they knew nothing at all. He turned off his computer and unplugged the earphones and doused the lights and got into bed, quietly and also carefully, because Killer was in there already. She was down at the bottom. She liked it there. She'd taken to licking his feet to get the salt off. It was ticklish. Head under the covers. He shook with silent laughter. Hammer. Several years passed. They must have passed, thinks Snowman. He can't actually remember much about them, except that his voice cracked and he began to sprout body hair. Not a big thrill at the time, except that it would have been worse not to. He got some muscles, too. He started having sexy dreams and suffering from lassitude. He thought about girls a lot, in the abstract, as it were, girls without heads, and about Wakulla Price with her head on, though she wouldn't hang out with him. Did he have zits? Was that it? He can't remember having any, though as he recalls, the faces of his rivals were covered in them. Corknut, he'd say to anyone who pissed him off. Anyone who wasn't a girl. No one but him and Alex the Parrot knew exactly what corknut meant, so it was pretty demolishing. It became a fad among the kids at the Healthwiser compound, so Jimmy was considered medium cool. Hey, corknut! His secret best friend was Killer. Pathetic that the only person he could really talk to was a rackunk. He avoided his parents as much as possible. His dad was a corknut, and his mother was a drone. He was no longer frightened by their negative electrical field. He simply found them tedious, or so he told himself. At school, he enacted a major piece of treachery against them. He'd draw eyes on each of his index finger knuckles and tuck his thumbs inside his fists. Then, by moving the thumbs up and down to show the mouths opening and closing, he could make these two hand puppets argue together. His right hand was Evil Dad. His left hand was Righteous Mom. Evil Dad blustered and theorized and dished out pompous bullshit. Righteous Mom complained and accused. In Righteous Mom's cosmology, Evil Dad was the sole source of hemorrhoids, kleptomania, global conflict, bad breath, tectonic plate fault lines, and clogged drains, as well as every migraine headache and menstrual cramp Righteous Mom had ever suffered. This lunchroom show of his was a hit. A crowd would collect with requests, "Jimmy, Jimmy, do Evil Dad!" The other kids had lots of variations and routines to suggest, filched from the private lives of their own parental units. Some of them tried drawing eyes on their own knuckles, but they weren't as good at the dialogue. Jimmy felt guilty sometimes, afterwards, when he'd gone too far. He shouldn't have had Righteous Mom weeping in the kitchen because her ovaries had burst. He shouldn't have done that sex scene with the Monday special fish finger, 20% real fish, Evil Dad falling upon it and tearing it apart with lust, because Righteous Mom was sulking inside an empty Twinkies package and wouldn't come out. Those skits were undignified, though that alone wouldn't have stopped him. They were also too close to an uncomfortable truth Jimmy didn't want to examine. But the other kids egged him on, and he couldn't resist the applause. "Was that out of line, Killer?" he would ask. "Was that too vile?" Vile was a word he'd recently discovered. Righteous Mom was using it a lot these days. Killer would lick his nose. She always forgave him. One day Jimmy came home from school, and there was a note on the kitchen table. It was from his mother. He knew as soon as he saw the writing on the outside, "For Jimmy," underlined twice in black, what sort of note it would be. "Dear Jimmy," it said. "Blah, blah, blah. Suffered with conscience long enough, blah, blah. No longer participate in a lifestyle that is not only meaningless in itself, but blah, blah." She knew that when Jimmy was old enough to consider the implications of blah, blah, he would agree with her and understand. She would be in contact with him later, if there was any possibility. Blah, blah search will be conducted inevitably, thus necessary to go into hiding. A decision not taken without much soul-searching and thought and anguish, but blah. She would always love him very much. Maybe she had loved Jimmy, thinks Snowman, in her own manner, though he hadn't believed it at the time. Maybe, on the other hand, she hadn't loved him. She must have had some sort of positive emotion about him, though. Wasn't there supposed to be a maternal bond? "P.S.," she'd said, "I have taken Killer with me to liberate her, as I know she will be happier living in a wild, free life in the forest." Jimmy hadn't believed that either. He was enraged by it. How dare she? Killer was his, and Killer was a tame animal. She'd be helpless on her own. She wouldn't know how to fend for herself. Everything hungry would tear her into furry black and white pieces. But Jimmy's mother and her ilk must have been right, thinks Snowman. And Killer and the other liberated rackhunks must have been able to cope just fine. Or how else to account for the annoyingly large population of them now infesting this neck of the woods? Jimmy had mourned for weeks. No, for months. Which one of them was he mourning the most, his mother or an altered skunk? His mother had left another note. Not a note, a wordless message. She'd trashed Jimmy's father's home computer. And not only the contents, she'd taken the hammer to it. Actually, she'd employed just about every single tool in Jimmy's father's neatly arranged and seldom used Mr. Home Handyman toolbox. But the hammer seemed to have been her main weapon of choice. She'd done her own computer, too, if anything more thoroughly. Thus, neither Jimmy's father nor the Corpsichore men who were soon all over the place had any idea of what coded messages she might have been sending, what information she may or may not have downloaded and taken out with her. As for how she'd got through the checkpoints and the gates, she'd said she was going for a root canal procedure to a dentist in one of the modules. She'd had the paperwork, all the necessary clearances, and the backstory was real. The root canal specialist at the Healthwiser Dental Clinic had toppled over with a heart attack, and his replacement hadn't arrived, so they were contracting out. She'd even made a genuine appointment with the module dentist, who'd billed Jimmy's dad for the time when she hadn't shown up. Jimmy's dad refused to pay because it wasn't his missed appointment. He and the dentist had a shouting match about it later, over the phone. She hadn't packed any luggage. She'd been smarter than that. She'd booked a Corpsichore man as protection in the taxi ride from the sealed bullet train station through the short stretch of plebe land that had to be crossed before reaching the perimeter wall of the module, which was the usual thing to do. No one questioned her. She was a familiar sight, and she had the requisition and the pass and everything. No one at the compound gate had looked inside her mouth, though there wouldn't have been much to see. Nerve pain wouldn't have shown. The Corpsichore man must have been in cahoots with her, or else he'd been done away with. In any case, he didn't come back, and he was never found. Or so it was said. That really stirred things up. It meant there had been others involved. But what others? And what were their goals? It was urgent that these matters be clarified, said the Corps guys who grilled Jimmy. Had Jimmy's mother ever said anything to him? The corpsman asked. Like, what did they mean by anything? Said Jimmy. There were the conversations he'd overheard on his mini-mics, but he didn't want to talk about those. There were the things his mother rambled on about sometimes, about how everything was being ruined and would never be the same again, like the beach house her family had owned when she was little, the one that got washed away with the rest of the beaches and quite a few of the eastern coastal cities when the sea level rose so quickly, and then there was that huge tidal wave from the Canary Islands volcano. They'd taken it in school, in the geoeconomics unit. Jimmy had found the video simulation pretty exciting. And she used to snivel about her grandfather's Florida grapefruit orchard that had dried up like a giant raisin when the rains had stopped coming. The same year Lake Okeechobee had shrunk to a reeking mud puddle, and the Everglades had burned for 3 weeks straight. But everyone's parents moaned on about stuff like that. Remember when you could drive anywhere? Remember when everyone lived in the plebe lands? Remember when you could fly anywhere in the world without fear? Remember hamburger chains? Always real beef. Remember hot dog stands? Remember before New York was New New York? Remember when voting mattered? It was all standard lunchtime hand puppet stuff. Oh, it was all so great once. Boo-hoo. Now I'm going into the Twinkies package. No sex tonight. His mother was just a mother, Jimmy told the Corpsichore man. She did what mothers did. She smoked a lot. She belonged to any, like, organizations? Any strange folk come to the house? She spent a lot of time on the cell phone? Anything you could help us out with, we'd appreciate it, son, said the other corpsman. It was the son that clinched it. Jimmy said he didn't think so. Jimmy's mother had left some new clothes for him, in the sizes she said he would soon grow into. They were sucky, like the clothes she always bought. Also, they were too small. He put them away in a drawer. His father was rattled. You could tell. He was scared. His wife had broken every rule in the book. She must have had a whole other life, and he'd had no idea. That sort of thing reflected badly on a man. He said he hadn't kept any crucial information on the home computer she'd wrecked. But of course, he would have said that. And there was no way of proving otherwise. Then he'd been debriefed elsewhere for quite a long time. Maybe he was being tortured, as in old movies or on some of the nastier websites, with electrodes and truncheons and red-hot nails, and Jimmy worried about that and felt bad. Why hadn't he seen it all coming and headed it off, instead of playing at mean ventriloquism? Two cast-iron Corpsichore women had stayed in the house while Jimmy's father was away, looking after Jimmy, or so it was called. A smiling one and a flat-faced one. They made a lot of phone calls on their ether cells. They went through the photo albums and Jimmy's mother's closets and tried to get Jimmy to talk.
She looks really pretty. You think she had a boyfriend? Did she go to the plebe lands much?
Why would she go there, said Jimmy, and they said some people like to. Why, said Jimmy again, and the flat-faced one said some people were twisted, and the smiling one laughed and blushed and said you could get things out there you couldn't get in here. What sort of things, Jimmy wanted to ask, but he didn't because the answer might entangle him in more questions about what his mother liked or might want to get. He'd done all of his betrayal of her in the Healthwiser High lunchroom. He wasn't going to do any more. The two of them cooked terrible leathery omelets in an attempt to throw Jimmy off guard by feeding him. After that didn't work, they microwaved frozen dinners and ordered in pizza.
So, your mother go to the mall a lot? Did she go dancing?
I bet she did. Jimmy wanted to slug them. If he'd been a girl, he could have burst into tears and got them to feel sorry for him and shut them up that way. After Jimmy's dad came back from wherever he'd been taken, he'd had counseling. He looked like he needed it. His face was green and his eyes were red and puffy. Jimmy had counseling too, but it was a waste of time.
You must be unhappy that your mother's gone.
Yeah, right.
You mustn't blame yourself, son. It's not your fault she left.
How do you mean?
It's okay, you can express your emotions. Which ones would you like me to express?
No need to be hostile, Jimmy. I know how you feel.
So if you already know how I feel, why are you asking me?
And so on. Jimmy's dad told Jimmy that they two fellows would just have to forge ahead the best way they could. So they did forge ahead. They forged and they forged. They poured out their own orange juice in the morning and put the dishes in the dishwasher when they remembered, and after a few weeks of forging, Jimmy's dad lost his greenish tint and started playing golf again. Underneath, you could tell he wasn't feeling too shabby now that the worst was over. He began whistling while he shaved. He shaved more. After a decent interval, Ramona moved in. Life took on a different pattern, which involved bouts of giggly, growly sex going on behind doors that were closed but not soundproof, while Jimmy turned his music up high and tried not to listen. He could have put a bug in their room, taken in the whole show, but he had a strong aversion to that. Truth to tell, he found it embarrassing. Once there was a difficult encounter in the upstairs hall. Jimmy's father in a bath towel, ears standing out from the sides of his head, jowls flushed with the energy of his latest erotic tussle, Jimmy red with shame and pretending not to notice. The two hormone-sodden love bunnies might have had the decency to do it in the garage instead of rubbing Jimmy's nose in it all the time. They made him feel invisible. Not that he wanted to feel anything else. How long had they been going at it, Snowman wonders now. Had the two of them been having it off behind the pigoon pens in their biosuits and germ-filtering face masks? He doesn't think so. His father was a nerd, not a shit. Of course he could be both, a nerdy shit, a shitty nerd. But his father, or so he believes, was too awkward and bad at lying to have become involved in full-fledged treachery and betrayal without Jimmy's mother noticing. Though maybe she had noticed. Maybe that was why she'd fled, or part of the reason. You don't take a hammer, not to mention an electric screwdriver and a pipe wrench, to a guy's computer without being quite angry. Not that she hadn't been angry in general. Her anger had gone way beyond any one motive. The more Snowman thinks about it, the more he's convinced that Ramona and his father had refrained. They'd waited till Jimmy's mother had buggered off in a splatter of pixels before toppling into each other's arms. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done so much earnest, blameless gazing at each other in Andre's Bistro at Organ Inc. If they'd been having a thing already, they'd have been brusque and businesslike in public. They'd have avoided each other, if anything. They'd have had quick and dirty trysts in grungy corners, weltering around in their own popped buttons and stuck zippers on the office carpet, chewing each other's ears in car parks. They wouldn't have bothered with those antiseptic lunches with his father staring at the tabletop while Ramona liquefied the raw carrots. They wouldn't have salivated on each other over the greenery and pork pies while using young Jimmy as a human shield. Not that Snowman passes judgment. He knows how these things go, or used to go. He's a grown-up now, with much worse things on his conscience. So who is he to blame them? He blames them. Ramona sat Jimmy down and gazed at him with her big, black-fringed, smudgy, sincere eyes and told him that she knew this was very hard on him, and it was a trauma for them all. It was hard on her, too, though maybe he, you know, might not think so, and she was aware that she couldn't replace his real mother, but she hoped maybe they could be buddies. Jimmy said sure, why not, because apart from her connection with his father, he liked her well enough and wanted to please her. She did try. She laughed at his jokes, a little late sometimes. She was not a word person, he reminded himself. And sometimes when Jimmy's father was away, she microwaved dinner for just herself and Jimmy. Lasagna and Caesar salad were her staples. Sometimes she would watch DVD movies with him, sitting beside him on the couch, making them a bowl of popcorn first, pouring melted butter substitute onto it, dipping into it with greasy fingers she'd lick during the scary parts while Jimmy tried not to look at her breasts. She asked him if there was anything he wanted to ask her about, like, you know, her and his dad and what had happened to the marriage. He said there wasn't. In secret, in the night, he yearned for Killer. Also, in some corner of himself he could not quite acknowledge, for his real, strange, insufficient, miserable mother. Where had she gone? What danger was she in? That she was in danger of some sort was a given. They'd be looking for her, he knew that, and if he were her, he wouldn't want to be found. But she'd said she would contact him, so why wasn't she doing it? After a while, he did get a couple of postcards with stamps from England, then Argentina. They were signed Aunt Monica, but he knew they were from her. "Hope you're well," was all they said. She must have known they'd be read by about 100 snoops before even getting to Jimmy, and that was right, because along came the corpsman after each one, asking who Aunt Monica was. Jimmy said he didn't know. He didn't think his mother was in any of the countries the stamps were from, because she was way smarter than that. She must have got other people to mail them for her. Didn't she trust him? Evidently not. He felt he'd disappointed her. He'd failed her in some crucial way. He'd never understood what was required of him. If only he could have one more chance to make her happy. "I am not my childhood," Snowman says out loud. He hates these replays. He can't turn them off. He can't change the subject. He can't leave the room. What he needs is more inner discipline, or a mystic syllable he could repeat over and over to tune himself out. What were those things called? Mantras. They'd had that in grade school. Religion of the week. "All right, class. Now, quiet as mice, that means you, Jimmy. Today we're going to pretend we live in India, and we're going to do a mantra. Won't that be fun? Now let's all choose a word, a different word, so we can each have our own special mantra." "Hang on to the words," he tells himself. "The odd words, the old words, the rare ones. Valance, Norn, Serendipity, Pibroch, Lubricious." When they're gone out of his head, these words, they'll be gone, everywhere, forever. As if they had never been. Crake. A few months before Jimmy's mother vanished, Crake appeared. The two things happened in the same year. What was the connection? There wasn't one, except that the two of them seemed to get on well together. Crake was among the scant handful of Jimmy's friends that his mother liked. Mostly she'd found his male pals juvenile, his female ones airheaded or sluttish. She'd never used those words, but you could tell. Crake, though, Crake was different. More like an adult, she'd said. In fact, more adult than a lot of adults. You could have an objective conversation with him, a conversation in which events and hypotheses were followed through to their logical conclusions. Not that Jimmy ever witnessed the two of them having such a conversation, but they must have done, or else she wouldn't have said that. When and how did these logical, adult conversations take place? He's often wondered. Your friend is intellectually honorable, Jimmy's mother would say. He doesn't lie to himself. Then she'd gaze at Jimmy with that blue-eyed, wounded-by-him look he knew so well. If only he could be like that, intellectually honorable. Another baffling item on the cryptic report card his mother toted around in some mental pocket, the report card on which he was always just barely passing. Jimmy would do better at intellectual honorableness if only he would try harder. Plus, if he had any fucking clues about what the fuck it meant. I don't need supper, he'd tell her yet again. I'll just grab a snack. If she wanted to do that wounded thing, she could do it for the kitchen clock. He'd fixed it so the robin said hoot and the owl said caw, caw. Let her be disappointed with them for a change. He had his doubts about Crake's honorableness, intellectual or otherwise. He knew a bit more about Crake than his mother did. When Jimmy's mother took off like that, after the rampage with the hammer, Crake didn't say much. He didn't seem surprised or shocked. All he said was that some people needed to change, and to change they needed to be elsewhere. He said a person could be in your life and then not in it anymore. He said Jimmy should read up on the Stoics. That last part was mildly aggravating. Crake could be a little too instructive sometimes, and a little too free with the shoulds. But Jimmy appreciated his calmness and lack of nosiness. Of course, Crake wasn't Crake yet at that time. His name was Glenn. Why did it have two N's instead of the usual spelling? My dad liked music, was Crake's explanation once Jimmy got around to asking him about it, which had taken a while. He named me after a dead pianist. Some boy genius with two N's. So did he make you take music lessons?
No,
said Crake. He never made me do much of anything. Then what was the point?
Of what?
Of your name, the two N's.
Jimmy, Jimmy, said Crake. Not everything has a point.
Snowman has trouble thinking of Crake as Glenn. So thoroughly has Crake's later persona blotted out his earlier one. The Crake side of him must have been there from the beginning, thinks Snowman. There was never any real Glenn. Glenn was only a disguise. So in Snowman's reruns of the story, Crake is never Glenn, and never Glenn alias Crake, or Crake slash Glenn, or Glenn comma later Crake. He is always just Crake, pure and simple. Anyway, Crake saves time, thinks Snowman. Why hyphenate? Why parenthesize, unless absolutely necessary? Crake turned up at Healthweiser High in September, or October, one of those months that used to be called autumn. It was a bright, warm, sunny day, otherwise undistinguished. He was a transfer, the result of some headhunt involving a parental unit. These were frequent among the compounds. Kids came and went, desks filled and emptied, friendship was always contingent. Jimmy wasn't paying much attention when Crake was introduced to the class by Mellons Riley, their hood room and ultra texts teacher. Her name wasn't Mellons, that was a nickname used among the boys in the class, but Snowman can't remember her real name. She shouldn't have bent down so closely over his Rita screen, her large round breasts almost touching his shoulder. She shouldn't have worn her Newskins t-shirt tucked so tightly into her zip-leg shorts. It was too distracting. So that when Mellons announced that Jimmy would be showing their new classmate Glenn around the school, there was a pause while Jimmy scrambled to decipher what it was she just said.
"Jimmy, I made a request," said Mellons.
"Sure, anything," said Jimmy, rolling his eyes and leering, but not taking it too far. There was some class laughter. Even Miss Riley gave him a remote, unwilling smile. He could usually get round her with his boyish charm act. He liked to imagine that if he hadn't been a minor, and she his teacher and subject to abuse charges, she'd have been gnawing her way through his bedroom walls to sink her avid fingers into his youthful flesh. Jimmy had been full of himself back then, thinks Snowman, with indulgence and a little envy. He'd been unhappy, too, of course. It went without saying, his unhappiness. He'd put a lot of energy into it. When Jimmy got around to focusing on Crake, he wasn't too cheered. Crake was taller than Jimmy, about 2 inches, thinner, too. Straight brown-black hair, tanned skin, green eyes, a half-smile, a cool gaze. His clothes were dark in tone, devoid of logos and visuals and written commentary, a no-name look. He was possibly older than the rest of them, or trying to act it. Jimmy wondered what kinds of sports he played. Not football, nothing too brawny, not tall enough for basketball. He didn't strike Jimmy as a team player, or one who would stupidly court injury. Tennis, maybe. Jimmy himself played tennis. At lunch hour, Jimmy collected Crake, and the two of them grabbed some food. Crake put down two giant soy sausage dogs and a big slab of coconut-style layer cake, so maybe he was trying to bulk up. And then they trudged up and down the halls and in and out of the classrooms and labs, with Jimmy giving the running commentary. Here's the gym. Here's the library. Those are the readers. You have to sign up for them before noon. In there's the girls' shower room. There's supposed to be a hole drilled through the wall, but I've never found it. If you want to smoke dope, don't use the can. They've got it bugged. There's a micro lens for security in that air vent. Don't stare at it, or they'll know you know. Crake looked at everything, said nothing. He volunteered no information about himself. The only comment he made was that the chem lab was a dump. Well, stuff it, Jimmy thought. If he wants to be an asshole, it's a free country. Millions before him have made the same life choice. He was annoyed with himself for jabbering and capering, while Crake gave him brief, indifferent glances and that one-sided demi-smile. Nevertheless, there was something about Crake. That kind of cool slouchiness always impressed Jimmy, coming from another guy. It was the sense of energies being held back, held in reserve for something more important than present company. Jimmy found himself wishing to make a dent in Crake, get a reaction. It was one of his weaknesses, to care what other people thought of him. So after school he asked Crake if he'd like to go to one of the malls, hang out, see the sights. Maybe there would be some girls there, and Crake said, why not? There wasn't much else to do after school in the Healthwiser compound, or in any of the compounds, not for kids their age, not in any sort of group way. It wasn't like the Plebelands. There, it was rumored, the kids ran in packs, in hordes. They'd wait until some parent was away, then get right down to business. They'd swarm the place, waste themselves with loud music and toking and boozing, fuck everything including the family cat, trash the furniture, shoot up, overdose. Glamorous, thought Jimmy. But in the compounds the lid was screwed down tight. Night patrols, curfews for growing minds, sniffer dogs after hard drugs. Once they'd loosened up, let in a real band, the Plebeland Dirtballs it had been. But there'd been a quasi-riot, so no repeats. No need to apologize to Crake, though. He was a compound brat himself. He'd know the score. Jimmy was hoping he might catch a glimpse of Wakulla Price at the mall. He was still sort of in love with her. But after the I value you as my friend speech she'd ruined him with, he'd tried one girl and then another, ending up currently with blonde Linda Lee. Linda Lee was on the rowing team and had muscular thighs and impressive pecs, and had smuggled him up to her bedroom on more than one occasion. She had a foul mouth and more experience than Jimmy, and every time he went with her he felt as if he'd been sucked into a pachinko machine, all flashing lights and random tumbling and cascades of ball bearings. He didn't like her much, but he needed to keep up with her, make sure he was still on her list. Maybe he could get Crake into the queue. Do him a favor. Build up some gratitude equity. He wondered what kind of girls Crake preferred. So far there'd been zero signals. At the mall there was no Wakulla to be seen, and no Linda Lee. Jimmy tried calling Linda Lee, but her cell phone was off. So Jimmy and Crake played a few games of three-dimensional Waco in the arcade, and had a couple of Soyo Boy Burgers. No beef that month, said the chalkboard menu. And an iced half a cappuccino, and half a Jolt bar each to top up their energy and mainline a few steroids. Then they ambled down the enclosed hallway, with its fountains and plastic ferns, through the warm bathwater music they always played in there. Crake was not exactly voluble, and Jimmy was about to say he had to go do his homework, when up ahead there was a noteworthy sight. It was Melons Riley, with a man, heading towards one of the adults-only dance clubs. She'd changed out of her school clothes and had on a loose red jacket over a tight black dress, and the man had his arm around her waist, inside the jacket. Jimmy nudged Crake, You think he's got his hand on her ass? He said.
That's a geometrical problem, said Craig. You'd have to work it out.
What? Said Jimmy. Then, how?
Use your neurons, said Craig. Step one. Calculate length of man's arm using single